turn on the tape. Welcome, everyone, to our third meeting on surrogacy, the Legislative Commission on Surrogacy. It's August 16th, 2016. I'm Senator Alice Johnson and Representative Peggy Scott, who are co-chairs of this commission. Today, if you look in your draft work plan, you should have a copy of that in your, hopefully it's right behind your agenda. So we'll look at, you know, meeting three, considerations related to different forms of surrogacy, and considerations related to the potential exploitation of women in surrogacy arrangements. And that is a very important part of this discussion for me. So with that, we would have someone move the minutes from the last meeting, which was on July 19th.
I'll move those minutes.
Representative Scott moves it. Any discussion? Not. Oh, all those in favor, first of all. So better say
aye.
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 Okay. Motion adopted. So today we had a very large number of people who have asked to speak, but we have the people that are here to talk about the issues that we want to have information. And I want to remind us all that we are a fact-finding group. This is not really the time that we're being persuaded to do something as legislators. When we get to a law, we try to persuade people to do what we think is the right thing to do. So if you have information for us, it's absolutely key for us to have that. So we are going to continue to try to do that, and I hope that will work today, too. So, Peggy, would you like to say something?
No, I just appreciate everyone being here today, and any member comments before we get started? If not, then we'll call the first person to the testifier's table.
Let's talk about, we have kind of split the
sure.
time,
yes.
About an hour for the first group of people, starting with Deborah Simmons, and then down to the Mr. Langfeld, right? Is that where he starts? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
For the second hour.
The second hour, I believe, Mr. Langfeld, are you here to talk about the second item in our agenda, the potential exploitation of women?
Yes.
Okay. So the first hour would be from Deborah Simmons down to Samantha Levine, and the second hour would be Mr. Langfeld, Ms. Collette, and Mr. Cassidy.
Okay. So with that, we'll start with Deborah Simmons.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Simmons.
Very good.
I'm on the phone. I'm on vacation, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you by phone this morning. I've been a clinical member of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine's mental health professional group since 1999. The ASRM is the U.S. Medical Society for all professionals that work in the reproductive medicine field. As a state-licensed mental health professional and a member of National Accrediting Association, I must meet clear, well-defined national standards to take actions in the best interests of my patients. This includes gestational carrier candidates. Once assumptions determine conclusions, if you start with an assumption that all gestational carriers are ignorant, poor, disadvantaged, and otherwise incapable of making their own decisions, you may end up in a place that leads to fears of exploitation of gestational carriers. If you start with an assumption that women are able to make their own decisions about their own bodies, a year of their lives, and why they want to help others, the conclusions come out in a very different place. I've seen over 200 potential surrogates, some through agencies, some in independent matches, some within the family, or some with friends. I will not work with traditional surrogates because traditional surrogacy does not conform with national practice standards. Similarly, I will not work with women on medical assistance. I am a gatekeeper. I have stopped women from being gestational carriers, whom I feel are naive about the rigors of the process, the risks of pregnancy, or who have been too interested in receiving compensation. I have rejected women from becoming gestational carriers when their partners are too interested in receiving compensation or not supportive of gestational surrogacy. I am a supporter of compensation for surrogacy because it means that everyone has some skin in the game, both the surrogate and the intended parent or parents. Everyone is invested in a safe process. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine requires medical, mental health, and legal evaluation for all potential gestational carriers. The risk of exploitation rises considerably when people do things outside of the safe process that we have determined works in Minnesota and around the United States. You may hear about cases in which women have been exploited. These are cases in which mental health screening did not occur, or when people did their own contracts without legal counsel. If any of those steps are skipped to save money, to save time, or because people are not paying attention to the risks, then there is the risk of a problem. What you may not know is that there are surrogacy groups on Facebook and elsewhere online where women educate and mentor one another about how to do gestational carrier surrogacy safely. There is no tolerance for naivete in these groups. Safety is the number one consideration. These gestational carriers want state statutes that protect them and the intended parents. Pregnancy is what surrogacy is about, having babies. It is completely compatible with pro-life values. No one can be forced to terminate a pregnancy. Gestational carriers determine what they will or will not do about terminating a pregnancy before there is ever a contract or a pregnancy. Legal contracts protect both the gestational carrier and the intended parents, but that's not enough. Defining surrogacy in Minnesota law, as the legislatures in North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa have already done, will protect gestational carriers physically, emotionally, and legally. It will prevent them. It will prevent problems. I strongly encourage the commission to address this gap in Minnesota law. I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Simmons. Any questions from members or comments? Senator Pappas.
Dr. Simmons, I missed the beginning introduction in terms of a little bit about your background, you know, where you practice and how long you've been practicing, and are you exclusively working with people who have fertility issues, or is your practice a little broader?
About 70% of my practice is reproductive issues, so it could be infertility, surrogacy, pregnancy law. I practice at Partners in Healing of Minneapolis and at the Center for Reproductive Medicine in Minneapolis, and I've been in practice for almost 20 years. And a member of the American Society since 1999. So I see people for other things too, but mostly my focus is on reproduction and helping people to either have babies or to heal from the pregnancy traumas that they've had.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Simmons, then are people come to you or are they referred to you usually?
It could be either way. People are referred to me by clinics around the country, by agencies around the country, and then they also find me online.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Ms. Simmons, have you ever counseled a woman, Dr. Simmons, have you ever counseled a woman who... was in contract as a gestational or as a surrogate who later decided that she couldn't give up the child. Have you ever counseled such a woman?
Yes, I have.
And were they
once?
Go ahead.
Once.
Once. And were they referred to you by an agency, or did they seek you out and find you on their own?
These were people who found me on their own, but they worked with legal counsel, and that was a case of traditional surrogacy. I learned my lesson early in my career that I'm not doing that type of surrogacy any longer. And gestational surrogacy is the national standard now because people can separate differently and better when it's not their eggs and it's not their baby, and that's what surrogates will say.
Do you have data on that to back it up?
Data about?
That there's a difference in the separation.
Well, there's very little research about that. I provided testimony in the first hearing in July about that. Women who have gone through gestational surrogacy are very happy with the decisions that they've made. And Dr. Susan Gollenbach in England is the one who's done most of the research on that. And the women are very happy with their decision. They say that they would do it again and that the children are healthy and happy both in the families where the intended parents are living and also in the household of the surrogate themselves. The women know from the very beginning that this is not their baby, and they say that over and over again. And it might seem strange that you and I can't sort of get that in our minds, but they sure have it in their minds. And they feel as though they are the protectors of these children for the intended parents. They see this as a gift, a blessing.
There's Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Simmons, have there been any studies done I suppose probably not, because this is fairly a new concept. But have there been any studies done on the siblings of a surrogate baby? So what I'm saying is the surrogate mother's carrying a child, and usually she has children of her own. Have there been any studies on those kids?
Well, I prefer to call them gestational carriers, not surrogate mothers, because they're not mothers of those children who they then offer to the intended parents. Susan Gollenbach is the only one who's done that sort of research, and what she has said is that the siblings of the child who goes to live in the other house are happy and see it as a blessing also, that they're thrilled about it because they know that their mother has helped someone.
Dr. Simmons, I have a question. Do you deal or help your surrogates, possible surrogates, to coming into your office? Do you help them to build contracts?
No, I'm not an attorney. What I do is I talk with them about the emotional issues that go into things. Now, there may be some things that are similar to what goes into the legal contracts, but I am not an attorney. I leave that to the attorneys.
Would there be any recommendation that you would make regarding, you know, when I go to the doctor, I ask about things that maybe they don't know that much about, but they would say, you know, go to this person or that person, or be sure you check out on whatever one of your concerns are that I've heard you talk about today. Would that be something that you would be doing in your position?
Senator Johnson, I think you're asking, do I talk about risk? And I do that in two ways. I do that through psychological testing. That's one. And then I also talk about the possibilities of things that could be difficult so that it's not just a big pink party where everything is happy and shiny. They have to also understand that there are risks that go with any pregnancy. And they do understand that. Their partners understand it too.
Dr. Simmons, I'm just trying to figure out if, you know, most of us don't know everything about what happens in any transactions that we're not familiar with. So help from anyone is important. Because even if an attorney talks to you, you question sometimes whether they have all the answers, the right answers. You might want to go to another attorney. But So that's I would like to see some contracts. That's why I asked if you help to build contracts for these people. Thank you very much.
I talk with them about emotionally and psychologically using an interview and things like the MMPI and the personality assessment inventory. Is this person competent to proceed? And then do they understand that things can be difficult? They can end up on bed rest, for example. I talk about my own experience on bed rest. Talk to them about what it might be like at the hospital when it is time to hand that child to the intended parents. And I'll tell you that every single one of them cries, and it's with joy, because they'll say to me, I can't wait to see the intended parents' faces when they have a child.
Thank you, Dr. Simmons. Any other questions? Mr. Stebbins.
Dr. Simmons, have you ever had the opportunity or felt like you had the obligation to review a surrogacy contract in the context of your work as a physician?
Well, I'm a mental health professional, so I want to make that clear. If you're talking about legal contracts, no, I typically don't see the legal contract.
Has there been any situation where you think that there's either a necessity or an obligation on your part to review that contract in the context of your therapeutic work?
You know, I'm not an attorney, so I wouldn't know how to review a contract like that. There is one question that somebody brought in to me from their attorney, and they asked, what happens to the baby if I die? And I added that to my mental health list of things to ask about, because that's actually a question for the partner. So that's been my experience with the legal contracts. They're not coming to me for legal counsel. They're coming to me for emotional counsel. And I have releases of information so that I could talk with attorneys if it becomes necessary. But typically, I don't have any need to do that. And the attorneys don't either. When we do, if we do, and it's very, very seldom, like once in 10 years, then we would contact one another.
Thank you.
Representative Scott has another question, Dr. Simmons.
Thank you. Yeah. So in your practice then, if you're counseling a person and kind of screening them as to whether or not they would make a good surrogate, or if they would be able to, you know, go through everything that is entailed in being a surrogate and then be able to give up the child, if you find that that person really, it's not a good idea for them to do that, do you just tell them, or because of the, you know, the doctor-client privilege, are you able to share that information with an agency? I mean, what if you recommend highly that they do not follow through and be in a surrogate, but they do it anyway? Is there anything to prevent that from happening?
Well, I have people sign releases of information for me, so I like to have things above board. There is nothing to stop people from doing stupid things in this world. So we, you know, I certainly have spoken with agencies to say this is not a candidate to proceed, and they listen immediately. If it's coming through an attorney, I will say the same thing. If it's coming through a physician, I will say the same thing, because I have to think about the do no harm part. I don't want anybody to be harmed if I have anything to say about it. Now, could somebody go around the system? Yes, and that is what I addressed in my testimony today, that when people skip steps, that is when exploitation is possible. But that's what we want to prevent now. This is why we are asking for a statute, so that we all know, here are the rules. There are well-established standards, and that's what we want everybody that is possible to work through. Could one slip through? Unfortunately, yes, that is life. But most surrogates in this day and age, and especially on the internet, they are not interested in doing stupid things because somebody gets hurt.
Senator Rood.
Madam Chair. Dr. Simmons, I hear you talk about a safe process, transactions, statutes, contracts, and the emotional and psychological state of the surrogate. Do you deal at all with telling them the physical reality of the pregnancies, or do you only deal with the emotional? I mean, do you counsel them on the physical, what can happen during a pregnancy to them? The risks?
Well, I start them with discussion of this is a syringe, and you'll be using syringes, needles, in this process, and I show it to them to see if there's any needle phobia. I don't teach them how to do injections. That's up to the clinic. I talk with them about the possibility of problems in any pregnancy that happens any way that one conceives it, primarily about bed rest. The physicians are talking with them about whether or not they are physically a good candidate. And then we all have to talk to them about what happens if you have a stillbirth, what happens if you have a miscarriage. And this is a part of pregnancy. This is a part of my practice generally. But I'm not there to talk about the medicine of it. I'm talking about the emotional reaction to it.
Thank you.
Does that answer the question for you?
One more question. Dr. Simmons, yes, that does answer. So you're just basically the psychological and emotional part. You don't deal with the physical risks then. Someone else does that.
You know, it really is a collaborative effort. You can't talk about, you know, the emotions of pregnancy without talking about how one's body changes and you know, the possibility of things like a miscarriage. So it really, I'm not giving medical advice. That's beyond my scope. But I am certainly talking about the things that happen to women in pregnancy, including some of my own experience. These are women who have had pregnancy.
Dr. Simmons, I really appreciate, the interest everyone has. We could probably spend the whole 2 hours asking questions and talking to you. But I do want to just say one thing myself before I recognize Representative Scott. These are the things that I think that I am thinking about, and each of us is coming here because we're thinking about what's being said and what we read and so forth. For instance, this might be the time that I would write down, say, we should remember this discussion because it might be a requirement that we would put into some legislation that would say something like, and please don't take it seriously that I'm thinking that I'm going to put legislation out right today, but something to say that the attorney and the psychologist or doctor has to work together to make sure that people are, and that's just an idea. Again, modify it. I can see Kathy thinking, oh my, I don't know how that'll work, but
yeah,
this
but
is an example of what
like
I want.
That sounds like the right idea.
This is an example of right what idea. I want this, what I hope this commission can do. Representative Scott.
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Simmons, one of the very high, there's a very high likelihood that in many of these cases, more than one fertilized egg will be implanted or whatever. And so most of these contracts, from my understanding, address the issue of selective reduction. And do you counsel a woman through the likelihood that the intended parents may be asking her to do that, basically aborting one or more of these children? Is that something that you also counsel them through?
Yes, it is. And that happens, that's in my testimony that I wrote today, that is something that is determined before there's any contract, before there's any conversation with an intended parent, that a woman has to know what she can or cannot or will not do. And so for women who do not want to do selective reduction, typically with triplets or quadruplets or more, what I counsel them to do is to use one embryo. You know, why create problems? So in the United States, doctors are moving toward using one embryo whenever possible. And most agencies and most women have learned to accept no more than two embryos.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Simmons. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. And with that, we will. I'm asking for Dr. Lisa Erickson to come forward. Okay, if you would. I guess it's a long table, but if you maybe whatever, that's the way we usually do it.
Okay.
So, and this, there is no volume on the recording, so you have to speak up quite clearly. Welcome.
Welcome.
And please tell us a little bit about yourself. And
can you hear me without adjusting my microphone?
Pardon me?
Can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me testing?
I can't hear you.
Oh, these don't.
They don't
amplify.
They don't amplify.
No.
All right.
It records.
Have to use your outside
voice. It records.
Yeah, they're just here for recording.
All right. This is my
Thank
outside
you.
Voice. Hello, Madam Chair. I am a Minnesota-educated, University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic, board-certified OBGYN and reproductive endocrinology and infertility subspecialist. I am recently retired from the Center for Reproductive Medicine in Minneapolis. I am also speaking today on behalf of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. ASRM represents over 8,000 medical professionals across the country. There are over 400 member practices performing 95% of the assisted reproductive technologies, or ART, cycles in the United States. For those of you who have never experienced infertility, either personally or by association with someone you love, it may be hard to understand what this is all about. Infertility is an equal opportunity disease. One in eight couples in your district will have trouble getting pregnant. Most people at some point in their lives want to have children. It is something that is ingrained in our cultural, social, and religious values. Not being able to have a child is a devastating situation for most of the patients that we treat, and something that I have unfortunately personally experienced. Gestational surrogacy involves the incredible generous act of agreeing to carry a pregnancy for another couple for whom carrying a pregnancy is impossible or has significant risks. Gestational surrogacy involves in vitro fertilization, IVF, whereby sperm and egg are combined to create an embryo, which is subsequently transferred into a gestational carrier. Most often, the egg and sperm come from the couple intending to become parents, although on occasion, either or both may come from donors. In situations where donors are used, the issues are no different than in other cases of egg and sperm donation, which has been used legally to initiate thousands of births in Minnesota under well-established guidelines and regulations. We are subject to professional standards enforced by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, in addition to the standards set by the ASRM. We are required by our oath to take actions in the best interests of our patients. First, do no harm. We and other medical professionals are subject to significant state and national oversight as we serve patients confronted with infertility. Fertility clinic laboratories are subject to strict regulatory oversight as well. In these respects, the reproductive endocrinologists and the other healthcare professionals serving infertility patients are no different than oncologists, neurosurgeons, and other licensed healthcare professionals serving their patients. As in all aspects of ART, we adhere to guidelines established by our medical society, the ASRM, and the Food and Drug Administration concerning a host of issues dealing with gestational surrogacy. These guidelines, which you have before you, provide for the screening of genetic or intended parents and gestational carriers. These guidelines address the medical and psychological issues that confront the gestational carrier and the intended parents, as well as the hoped-for children. The guidelines address the legal issues and the important informed consent process that governs the treatment from the beginning to the end. The guidelines include criteria for rejecting intended parents and gestational surrogates with the relationship or circumstances are not appropriate. I have met in my practice in consultation with potential intended parents and potential gestational carriers. The primary motivation stated by the gestational carrier is usually the desire to help others and the enjoyment of pregnancy itself. These are the most amazing people I encounter who are both altruistic and healthy. If I squint, I can almost see a halo over their heads. These are gold medal gestators. They're fertile, and they're very good at pregnancy. The gift they are giving to the intended parents is beyond description. It brings tears to my eyes, goosebumps to my arms. I know of no better gift to give. This is a story about every baby being a deeply, desperately wanted baby. The patients find us, and we happen to have a technology that can make this work. This technology started in 1987 with Louise Brown and subsequently won the Nobel Prize. This technology has always been ahead of legislation. Those seeking to build families deserve the opportunity to pursue treatment that is most appropriate for them. It is important. Our work is important today to provide the safeguards for all the parties involved in this collaborative reproduction. When the medical process is over and the child is born, it is important to make certain that the legal rights and statuses of all parties is immediately clear. The ones who intended to be parents of the child need to be recognized as parents. The donors and surrogates who want to help but have no intention of being a parent need to be certain that their rights are protected. It is important that the intent of the parties to a surrogacy agreement is formalized in a written legal agreement. This includes the children born of such agreements, the intended parents, the gestational carriers, who are all part of such agreements. Surrogacy is an issue that forces society to re-examine traditional concepts of parenthood and family structure. It is also an issue that requires us to reaffirm the ideals and values we have within the context of the law, the dignity of the individual to exercise liberty and autonomy as defined by his or herself. Thank you, and I welcome your questions.
Dr. Erickson, any questions, comments? Senator Pappas.
Dr. Erickson, I think it would be helpful for us if you would kind of walk us through an example of the kind of person who might come to your practice and what kind of screening you would provide.
I'm going to refer to this orange sheet of paper, which might be helpful for you as I talk you through it. If you take a look at the intended parents, an intended parents, which would be our purple couple.
I don't know if everyone has that sheet yet. But I know they're here.
Right toward the top of our
packets.
Oh, here. Okay, got it.
An intended couple might be our purple couple. This is going to be our intended parents are going to be looking at in demonstration form today. This couple might present to me for a variety of different reasons. One, the woman might have when we heard last year at this in the legislature, we heard about a gestational carrier who carried babies for her sister. Her sister had four children and a subsequent hysterectomy. The four children were subsequently killed in a car accident. And so she asked her sister if she would carry a pregnancy for her, and the sister agreed. So a circumstance of a hysterectomy in a dire family situation would be an intended parent. Another intended parent would be somebody that had a life-threatening condition such as a stroke. And pregnancy would exacerbate that and put her at risk for additional stroke-like problems, if not terminal-type issues. So she chooses to have her own biological eggs, but to have another woman carry the pregnancy for her because pregnancy would be life-threatening to her. So the intended parents arrive, and often they don't have a gestational carrier in mind. They might have a family member or a friend volunteer or agree, and then we set about setting that into motion. You asked if we – our system is already in place. We have a trained psychological professional that takes care of the psychological needs. We have attorneys that are skilled in third-party reproduction that take care of the legal part of it. And then our job is basically fairly technical. We literally consult with the patients, sign consent forms, talk about the risks, the costs, the benefits, and proceed with egg retrieval procedures, fertilization of the embryos, and then transfer of the embryos into the gestational carrier. There's five clinics in Minnesota, and all of us perform this type of service. On the register in 2013, there was approximately 40 gestational carrier cycles recorded to the CDC in Minnesota.
Any other questions or comments, members? Senator, Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you. Doctor, could you talk a little bit about the medical, prescription therapies that a woman has to go through to be able to be a surrogate mother? Particularly if it's not a biological situation. There's hormone therapies and all different sorts of things. Could you talk about that? And then could you talk about the potential risks of that, those medications and so forth?
Madam Chair?
Doctor?
So the science behind preparing a gestational carrier's uterus for carrying a pregnancy is by mimicking what Mother Nature had in mind from the beginning. What we do is we prepare the lining by giving the mother estrogen pills, which mimics what happens in a natural menstrual cycle. Then we pretend that she ovulated by adding progesterone, and 7 days later we do the transfer of an embryo into the uterus. 9 days later we do the pregnancy test, and 2 weeks after the pregnancy test, we can see heartbeat.
And so, doctor, how many months prior to implantation does the woman have to be on those medications?
1 month.
1 month, okay.
It mimics a menstrual cycle to a T.
Okay.
And the closer we follow what's designed to happen in nature, the better our results have been.
And do you know of the potential side effects long-term of doing something like that?
The side effects are no different than a menstrual cycle that women go through every month. So the medications mimic the natural hormones. So there's no increased risk for breast or ovarian cancer associated with the medications that we use.
And once they are pregnant, do they continue to have to take any sort of medications?
They continue the estrogen and progesterone source until the placenta takes over, which is about 8 weeks gestation. And we tend to overlap that just a little bit more to make sure that the placenta has adequately taken over the full hormonal support, and then we stop all the medicine at 12 weeks gestation.
Okay. And do we know anything about the long-term effects or short-term effects of that?
Well, the amount of medicine that we're adding at that point is like a teaspoon to the ocean. So it's no different than any pregnancy on its own.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Doctor. I have a question in follow-up to Representative Scott's question, wondering about the 1 month that you referenced of preparation. Wondering if that has changed, that time frame has changed over the years. I am asking, I have a number of other quick questions, but I'm asking as I had have a friend who about maybe 15 years ago now went through what I thought was a lot longer period of time taking shots. I believe she went over to the University of Minnesota and was given shots, but it was a lot longer, and she ended up with some very severe complications as a result of that. So I'm just wondering to what degree the process may have changed over the years.
Oh, since I started in 1987 along these lines, and at those times we used large needles and intramuscular shots, and shots were given for a month in advance of the treatment option. Now the medication has drastically decreased. The needles have gotten smaller, and the doses and the duration has gotten a lot less. So as a matter of fact, we're using vaginal medicine as opposed to intramuscular medicine now for dosing. And so what we are trying to do is to synchronize what happens naturally in a natural menstrual cycle. And if you provide a fertile uterus, it's all we need to do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Yes, thank you. And so in follow-up, what issues, if any, have you experienced in your practice over the years? I mean, that sounds like you've been in practice for approaching 30 years.
Yes.
And so I'm just curious, what experiences have you witnessed where things didn't just quite go according to plan?
First of all, I mentioned that this just takes a month, and it seems like it's like this, but this is a really slow process. You have to have the intention of having a baby. So let's take our purple couple, and they're thinking about it. They have to start by making an appointment with the fertility doc and thinking about it. Then they have to go and talk to Dr. Simmons. Then they have to meet with an attorney. And then they have testing to do. They have to have a physical exam by their, physical exams and STD screening. And there's just a lot of screening that takes a lot of time. From start to transfer, with all of that intentionality, can be 6 months easily. Once people are dated, we call that dated, and they're on the IVF calendar, that's like booking a seat on an airplane. You've got to buy a ticket. You've got to get in the queue. I think getting in the queue takes longer than the whole process. And that's our problem. That's a challenge for fertility clinics. Is that what you mean?
I'm so sorry. I didn't want to interrupt. But I was concerned more about the risks and, physically with regard to the 30 days and the injections, the pills, whatever that might be. To what degree have you experienced clients that have had adverse effects physically as a result of the preparation process?
The preparation process is so similar to being on a cycle of birth control pills that I haven't encountered any patients that have encountered concerns with taking the medication, because it's basically like taking a month of birth control pills.
Thank you. And then, Madam Chair, I have one other quick question.
Representative.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm wondering approximately what percent of clients that you see have, in fact, previously been mothers. Given birth.
For the gestational carriers, it is a prerequisite in our program to have given birth so that they understand the gift that they're giving.
Thank you.
100%.
Thank you.
Senator Rood.
Madam Chair and Dr. Erickson, so you said it takes 30 days. So does everyone get pregnant in 30 days? I mean, that's a pretty miraculous success rate if they have 30 days and they get pregnant.
That's only on prom night.
So, I mean, there have to be more than just one 30 days. I can't imagine that everybody gets pregnant in 30 days.
Madam Chair?
Dr.
What
Anderson.
I think of it is month one is where you're getting in the queue. Month one of the menstrual cycle that we work with. Month two is asking that menstrual cycle to do exactly what we want it to do. So each month, the first 2 weeks, you make estrogen, and then you make an egg, and you ovulate. In the second 2 weeks, you make progesterone. And right after that ovulation, the embryo conceives, and 5 days later, it implants. So that's all we're orchestrating. And it's like a finely tuned orchestra. It's 14 days of estrogen pills. Then we check an ultrasound and look at the lining of the uterus to see if it's ready. Then we add progesterone, and then we know that the transfer is going to be done on day six. So, and then the progesterone and the estrogen continue because it's an artificial cycle. The gestational carrier is not making her own estrogen and progesterone. It's an artificial cycle. Those medicines have to be maintained because they're maintaining the pregnancy until the placenta takes over. So it's just basic biology of the menstrual cycle.
Is that okay, Senator?
It's the same you were asking on the same topic.
So how many times does a woman have to go through the 1 month?
Right, does it implant right away?
What's your success
first time?
Rate?
Ah.
That's the question.
Well, okay. The success rate is available online at all clinics and through the CDC. We report our data to the Center for Disease Control, and so you can find that on SART.org for all the clinics in the United States. Being Minnesotans, we're not exactly allowed to brag, but the pregnancy rates are quite high when you have premium eggs and premium sperm and premium host carriers. So they're going to be about 60% per cycle.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair,
the concerns that we have as physicians and first do no harm for these, our concern is to make sure that the gestational carriers are safe. We recommend a single embryo transfer.
Two things. We have a time limit, unless we want to stay all day.
I just would like an answer to the question,
sure.
Madam Chair. So what I'm asking is if a woman goes and has the
transfer,
how many, on average, women have to do how many months of that in order to get pregnant? Because obviously it's not just 1 month. And so they're taking medication for not just 1 month, but maybe 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or 5 months. Mm-hmm. How long do you allow them to go? I mean, that's a lot of medication to go. And so, obviously it's not 30 days.
Well, keep in mind, Madam Chair, it's not a lot of medication. It is like taking a birth control pills for 1 month, okay? And it's very successful. So if people don't get pregnant the first cycle, we might orchestrate a second cycle, and they might orchestrate a third cycle. After a third cycle, there might be something wrong with either the embryos or with the host environment that we would reevaluate and choose a different course by altering any of the ingredients in the recipe.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Just real quickly, what does your clinic make per 30-day cycle? What is the income that you receive from that?
Well, let's see. I think services rendered would be for the ultrasounds and the laboratory tests. And for the embryology, which would be the finding of the eggs and the sperm and the making of the embryos and actually performing an embryo transfer. So those would be the costs for services rendered. The additional costs would be for medications for the gestational carrier.
Then
that would be it.
So what's that number?
I don't have that for you today, but I'm certainly able to provide that to you.
Did you have a ballpark?
It's usually a package price, and it depends on whether they're it depends on whether they're using their own eggs or donor egg. So I can't, there's different scenarios.
So,
own eggs for IVF would be about, that would include the retrieval. So it would be the screening for the intended parent and laboratory testing for the intended parent, ultrasounds for the intended parent, and then the retrieval process, fertilization in the lab, co-culture in the lab, and then it would be the transfer into the gestational carrier. So it's going to be, can I give a guesstimate of about $10,000?
And you could send us information if you'd like.
I can.
If you will, I should say. Mr. Stebbins.
Thank you. Doctor, is it ever advisable or necessary for you to review the legal contract between the intended parents and the surrogate or the gestational carrier?
Well, because we are not attorneys, all that we ask for is that the legal contract has occurred. So we ask for a letter from the attorney saying that a legal agreement has occurred, and that's all we review.
Thank you, Dr. Erickson.
Thank you for inviting me.
And members, we'll go for another 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and then we'll move to the second part of our schedule. So let's try to get everybody in. I'd really like to see that happen today. Crystal Lemke.
If I can, I'd like to pass on to the next meeting. I'm an agency member, so I'd like to see everybody.
Okay. I'm particularly interested in the forms, but so if we can get that.
Okay, nope, that's fine. I'm happy to come up and talk to the chair.
I've warmed it up for you.
Perfect. Yeah, what she said. Try to go fast.
She's an agency owner.
Women are excited to speak today, but I also think the testifiers we've heard today, I kind of bring some of these pieces together. Speak up. Okay, so. Hello, Madam Chair and Commission members. My name is Crystal Lemke. I am the owner of My Donor Connection. We're a third-party surrogacy egg donor agency located in Anoka, Minnesota. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. So my goal today is to provide you with some insight to my business practice as an agency owner. I've provided several documents for you guys, as you see, for you guys to review, and the purpose is to help you understand the preventative measures that I take to ensure the surrogate is properly advised and informed throughout the process. In these documents, you'll find the application for registration.
Crystal, please excuse me.
Yes.
If you could tell us what your information is.
That's what I'm coming up to next. In the documents, you're going to find the application for a gestational surrogate, an application for an intended parent, and then there's an informational handout for gestational surrogates who are interested in our program. So there should be three.
Got it. We have a lot of paper in here.
Yeah, I know a lot of it's from me.
So your information is the
My Donor.
My Donor Connection.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
An agency is involved in almost every aspect of the surrogate cycle. I know Deb had mentioned before she's kind of the gatekeeper. We our hands are in every aspect. We touch on the legal, we touch on the clinics, the psychologist, the surrogate, follow through all the way throughout the end of the journey. So you recommended a process where we all collaborate. That does happen, and I feel that that's one of the important tasks of an agency. There are two key roles in my duties that, if done correctly, should pave the way for a smooth journey for all parties involved, and that's the screening and the matching process. The screening process is extensive. When a surrogate wishes to be part of our program, we first confirm that they meet the minimum requirements before we invite them to complete a full application. Just to give you an idea, these minimum requirements, they must be a U.S. citizen. They cannot be on any form of government assistance. They've had healthy pregnancies that delivered full term without complications. They cannot have a history of drug use or alcohol abuse. They're willing to abstain from drugs, alcohol, and nicotine throughout the medical process and pregnancy. They're between the ages of 21 and 40. They are physically and mentally healthy with no history of anxiety or depression. They must be able to pass a background check as well as their spouse or partner, if applicable, and they must have the support of their family. Now, again, these are the minimum requirements. So only applicants who meet this criteria are invited to complete a full application, which you have a copy of in front of you as well. Once the application has been submitted, we schedule an interview with these surrogates so that we can get to know her better. This is a key piece. We go over the process. We answer questions. We address concerns we may have about her profile she submitted. and we discuss her views on surrogacy. We want to understand why she's considering surrogacy, what types of couples she would like to work with, what type of relationship she would like with those couples, and what support system she has going into the process. After the interview, if we believe that the applicant is a good fit for a surrogacy journey, we then proceed with obtaining the following. We get medical records, both OB and labor and delivery. We send these over to a reproductive endocrinologist who will review, and he'll make a recommendation. He, she will make a recommendation on proceeding with a surrogate. We obtain copies of her insurance policy for professional review. We proceed with a psychological evaluation for the surrogate as well as her partner, spouse, if applicable. And we conduct a background check for the surrogate and her partner. So just to give you an idea of the screening process, this year only 6% of women who have applied with my agency have made it to this point. So we're screening through a lot of women. A lot of these women, I mean, you're looking at the top. They've passed all of this information.
So that number was 6%?
6%, okay. Yep. So this is all done prior to the intended parents reviewing her profile. Once we have confirmation from the medical professional and licensed psychologist to proceed, we would then present her profile to intended parents that have the same philosophies as the surrogate or about the pregnancy. The other application in front of you is for the intended parents. We gather information on their relationship, their employment, their reason for pursuing surrogacy. We learn about their personality and their physical health. The profile of the surrogate is shared with an intended parent only if I feel they are compatible. If the parent feels she's a strong match, I would then share the parent's profile with the surrogate to see if she feels the same. The surrogate always has a choice when it comes to selecting which parent she will work with. Once a match is confirmed, the legal agreement is drafted between the surrogate and the intended parents. The surrogate is provided separate legal representation by an industry professional. Now, we know not every cycle goes smoothly, but it's my opinion that the majority of issues that we see in the media could have been prevented if proper screening and matching protocol had been followed. Thank you so much, and I'm open to your questions.
My question is how 6% of the people that you interview are possibly become surrogates. Who pays for all those 94 that don't pass?
That's why I know cost is a big picture, Madam Chair, is a big concern. But it takes a team to go through these applicants and to properly vet them, because we don't want somebody. We can't have them on government assistance. We can't have somebody who is their primary motivator is compensation. When I look at these surrogate applicants, I look to think, who would I want carrying my daughter? I have two children, and that's what I look at. So I want to look at the process and say, would I trust this woman? Would I, you know, and it's not just me. We have the psychological, we have the attorneys.
I'm not criticizing that at all, I don't mean to at all.
What
I'm wondering is who pays, do the women that come in and apply to become a gestational surrogate, do they have to pay money to have an interview with you?
No. There's no cost.
And then no one pays for that at all. The intended parents don't pay. If it takes 10 people, you interview 10 people
I understand.
That would
the intended parents
maybe
would
not be eligible for the intended parents.
Madam Chair, the intended parents would pay for the psychological evaluation of the surrogate that they proceed with. That would be included in their
just for one.
Fee. Just the one that they proceed with, that's correct. Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. How much does your agency make on a successful match and then birth following that?
Madam Chair and Commission members, I can tell you my agency fee, and it's different because we have refund policies. There's lots of other factors that go into it. Our agency fee is $17,000. What goes into that is the screening, the recruiting of these surrogates, and then following this journey from the point of screening to the birth of the child. We assist with the recommendations of attorneys, the recommendations of clinics, the psychological evaluation, the insurance policy. We purchase a program through of insurance program called Art Risk Solutions that manages the insurance throughout the process. Right there is $2,000. So there's a lot of expenses that agencies incur throughout the process to help ensure that everything goes smoothly. But the top agency fee is $17,000. Now, if they do not have a successful pregnancy, that agency fee can be refunded all the way up until, or I'm sorry, they can apply that to a new surrogate, but let's say that something goes wrong before embryo transfer and they don't proceed, we would refund that to the parents. I don't have the expectation that parents need to be out thousands of dollars for a process that they have to start over somewhere else. So either they can continue to work with me or they can go somewhere else and have a refund of their agency fee.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, another question. You mentioned that the surrogate mothers go through psychological testing. Do the intended parents also?
They do, and that's a clinic protocol, Madam Chair. Sorry. That is one of the clinic requirements. Each state has different legal requirements for this. Some require home visits. Some require a psychological evaluation. Oftentimes, clinics have a psychologist on staff that will review them and approve them.
Does your agency do international surrogacy?
We do.
Thank you.
We do accept intended parents internationally, not surrogates.
Any other questions? Mr. Papa.
Ms. Lemke, do you have any outcomes data about patient satisfaction or health of the children or any other statistics?
I don't, but I am constantly contacted by people doing polling, so I can make a recommendation as to what information you guys would like for their next survey. If you guys have recommendations, I'm open to that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your information. Gary Deebly. Deebly. I'd like to hear from you.
Okay, thank you.
We don't plan to take all of the surrogates, and those that have something new to tell us, that would be good, because again, we're trying to gather information, and we need to do that because we only have 10 meetings. Mr. Deebly.
Thank you, members of the commission. My name is Gary Deebly. I am an attorney who has been practicing. It'll be going on 30 years next year, primarily as a family law attorney, but with a specialty in adoption and assisted reproduction. I have two documents that I provided with you. One is my curriculum vitae, and the other is a law review article that I co-authored with attorney Susan Crocken on ethical issues in assisted reproduction. I think what you might find interesting in that article, at the beginning, there's a little bit of a prefatory history of assisted reproduction, and I compare it with adoption, so you'll get a sense of how that works. And by way of my background, just to hit a few of the highlights, I'm an attorney in private practice, and I represent intended parents, gestational carriers, egg donors, sperm donors, in all aspects of assisted reproduction. I do not have an agency, and I do not represent agencies that work in arts. And so the referrals, the cases that come to me are coming from people who find my service on my website or by referrals from other people, and they're looking for an attorney to represent them in some aspect of the arts process. By way of my professional work, I am a member of the American Academy of Assisted Reproduction Attorneys, the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and the International Academy of Family Law Attorneys. All of those groups that I belong to are dealing with various aspects of arts and adoption. I checked the statistics on my firm, and I've got another partner in my law firm who does similar work, and we have done close to 300 arts cases during the time that we've been doing this, and we've both been doing it for about 20 years. We've done thousands of adoptions. And so I can talk a little bit, if you want, about the different process of how that works in terms of the difference between adoption and assisted reproduction. The thing that I was asked to testify about was, and what's on your agenda today, is this issue of how do we protect surrogates from exploitation. And I think it's critically important, and you've already had reference to this, is that we've got a whole array of professionals involved in this process. We've got the medical professionals, we've got the legal professionals, we've got mental health professionals, and now we have agencies that are out there doing the matching and putting these processes together and charging fees for that. If you look at adoption, I'm also a legal historian, by the way, and so I won't bore you with a lot of history, but adoption sort of started out the same way that arts did back in the 1850s. It was put together by people who were interested in doing it. There was little regulation, and it just sort of evolved over time. Lots of concerns and lots of problems led it then to be the heavily regulated legal process that it is now. As you know, as legislators, we have a comprehensive adoption statute that's been on the books since the early 1900s. First adoption statute in the United States was in the 1850s. There was no such thing as adoption under English common law. It's a statutory creation. We're sort of seeing similar things happening with arts. People, there's very little law that has come about, but people are doing it. The medicine, as Dr. Erickson said, is far ahead of what the legal process is. And so that's what I think the purpose of your commission is to look at, is are we to the point now with assisted reproduction that we need to have some regulations, we need to have some statutes? And I, as a lawyer practicing in the field, would say, yes, we need that. One of our challenges, and I, as a lawyer, what I get involved in is drafting contracts, whether they're a gestational carrier contract, a traditional surrogacy contract, an egg donor contract. And then I get involved in the second part of the process, which is the parentage piece. How do I get a legally recognized parent-child relationship created out of this situation that we have? And I think it's critically important for the surrogate. I like to use the term gestational carrier, as I think it's a little more precise. I think it's critically important that they have their own separate representation to work with them, not only in the contract drafting stage and to explain what their rights are and what their interests are and to help them negotiate a contract that protects them, but also in the parentage process, because they are involved in that as well. Now, attorneys, we are governed by a board of ethics. Doctors are governed by a board of ethics. We all have to bring our ethical standards to bear on this, but in this area of law in particular, we have a higher duty of ethical responsibility. We're dealing with children. We have to be looking out for the best interests of the children. That's true whether you're a divorce lawyer, that's true whether you're an arts lawyer, an adoption lawyer. We've got all of these considerations that we as lawyers engaged in the ethical practice of law have to do. We are to be zealous advocates for our client, but we're also responsible for the process. We've got duties of candor to the tribunal that's deciding this. We've got duties to third parties that are involved in this. We cannot misrepresent. We cannot do things that violate our code of responsibility. So I think in order to protect the surrogates and the gestational carriers, that's critical, having good, competent legal representation that's going to work with them at all stages of the process. Now, one of the things that I think I'll end on is just talking about who I have represented and what I have seen in my practice thus far for the 20-plus years I've been doing this. I get clients that come to me, and I'll focus on the surrogate and the gestational carrier, are primarily either relatives. That's one of the most common. It'll often be a sister or a sister-in-law of one of the intended parents. They often resist the idea of having their own attorney. They say, oh, we're all family. We don't need an attorney. If I'm involved in those cases, I will insist that they have an attorney. If I'm representing the intended parents, I'm going to urge my clients to pay for them to have their own attorney. Think of it as an insurance policy. But it's critically important that there be that representation. Sometimes they absolutely refuse, and we can't force them to have an attorney. In those cases, I either won't do the case, or I will be very careful when I go through to make sure that everybody understands that I'm representing the intended parent, not the carrier. And I treat those very carefully. Other cases I get are going to be people coming in who have no relationship, and I may be representing the carrier, I may be representing the intended parent, but my duty is still the same, to represent that party in their particular piece of the process. And I think it's critically important, again, that there be good, competent representation. And we do work closely with medical providers. I will review medical consent forms to make sure my client, whoever it is, has been adequately represented. I will check to make sure what kind of mental health screening is done. I want to know what screening has been done for the carrier. If there's an agency involved, I'm going to look at that agency contract. What are my clients paying for? What are they getting for on that service? And if I've got questions, I'm going to ask about it. Sometimes the agencies will try to control fees that are paid. They'll put a cap on fees. And I'll tell them, you know, I'm going to get a question, what do I charge for this? I charge by the hour for what I do. I don't do flat fees typically, and I resist the idea of anyone capping my fees because I want to be able to represent my client as an attorney governed by my own ethical board. And so I typically will do a retainer of $1,500 if I'm representing a carrier or a surrogate, and my hourly rate is $425 an hour, and I've got support staff who works as well, and we do a separate retainer letter. If I'm representing the carrier or the surrogate and the intended parents are paying my fees, which is typical how that works, there will be a retainer letter that goes out to them where I explain clearly, I am not your attorney. You are paying my fees, but my loyalty is to my client, and I will be zealously representing my client, and that's what my fees will be based on. So we're very careful in the scope of our representation as to how we set out those terms. That law review article that I provided for you lists some of the ethical issues that are sort of at the heart of the assisted reproduction process. And so I think if you'll get some sense of kind of what we have to be concerned about, all of the professionals who are involved in these matters. And I think at that point I'll stop and take questions from the commission.
Mr. Stevens.
Mr. DeBilly, now you've described the process that you use
right.
in representing the clients that you have in these types of cases. Are other attorneys required by any type of process to use the same type of procedures you use?
No, that's one of the challenges is, you pretty much set up how you're going to represent people, how you're comfortable doing it. You have to obviously follow your board of professional standards, the attorney's ethics code, and do that. But you can do people do flat fees in this area. And people will set up their own arrangements. So there's a lot of variance from attorney to attorney as to how they do it.
Okay, and just as far as you've described, part of the process is you review the psychological examination, make sure there is one. You review these different parts of the process. Is there anything at all that directs other attorneys practicing in this area to do the same types of things?
No, there really isn't. And, again, if I can bring the analogy back to adoption practice, we have sort of a similar situation there in terms of legal representation. But in adoption agencies are heavily regulated. They have to be licensed. The Department of Human Services issues administrative regulations that deal with them. We don't have that yet in the arts area. And so you're going to see a lot more variance as to how parties do it and what happens. And some of that variance is what I discuss in that article in terms of the ethics issues.
Thank you.
Mr. Debo, in your practice, how many cases of exploitation or alleged exploitation or approximate percentage of litigation results when there are competent attorneys on both sides representing both carrier and parents?
I can tell you, in all honesty, in my practice with those 300-some cases I told you, we have not had any litigation with any of them. There have been exactly two litigated cases that have gone up in appeal in the state of Minnesota, so it's pretty rare that you get that. I'm currently been retained as an expert witness in a case on the East Coast where there is an issue with the carrier refusing to selectively reduce a pregnancy when the child was known to have serious birth defects. And there were some problems in the drafting of that contract and the language in it. And it's now led to litigation where the intended parents are suing the agency and the agency, basically, and the attorney representing the agency for malpractice. But I haven't had any of that in my own practice.
Let me ask this question. If a surrogate decides that they're 3 months pregnant, 2 months pregnant, and they decide they don't want to do this anymore, can they have an abortion?
Well, that's one of the very difficult issues that we'd address in the contracting is, and that's, in fact, that case I was referencing to, it goes to that language. I put in all of my contracts, and this is pretty standard language, that Roe versus Wade is the law of the land in terms of abortion. The only person who can compel a person to have an abortion is the birth mother herself. Nobody else can tell her she must abort that child. It's a common provision in these contracts, though, that if she agrees to that, to basically agree to selective reduction based on all the circumstances that are laid out, if it's recommended by a doctor, if the intended parents want that, she can be found to be in breach of the contract. And there could be civil damages, money damages that could be assessed, or the contract could be reformed. But she cannot be forced to have an abortion. And that's an issue that I spend a lot of time, and I think most good attorneys in this area spend a lot of time. If your client is the surrogate, you want to explain that to them. Do you understand? You're signing onto a contract that says you will abort this child if there's a problem and the doctors recommend it. But you also understand, and this is something we tell the intended parents, you cannot force her to have an abortion. And that is one of the most challenging areas of drafting from a legal standpoint in this area, is we've got that kind of an issue to deal with.
My question was whether the surrogate who is pregnant decides decides she does not want to carry that baby and she wants to have an abortion,
yeah,
and she has the right to because of Roe versus Wade.
And she can have that abortion, and then there are contractual consequences possibly.
Have you ever experienced that?
I have not. And the closest I've come is that case I was referencing where I'm going to be an expert testifying in that case. And that those cases are quite unusual, and has been my experience. And they typically, you're going to get a lot of press coverage on a case like that because it's going to be a rather difficult bit of litigation. But they're rare.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. If you could just put, just kind of highlight some of the aspects of what goes into a contract, a typical contract, just so our commission can kind of understand some of those items. Yeah, and we would love to see a sample contract, obviously, but go ahead.
Yes, there's really a few core common essential elements that you would see in almost every gestational carrier or surrogacy contract. Obviously, you identify the parties. You indicate what the goals are. The parties are working together to create a child that will be the legal child of the intended parents. And then you lay out all of the different terms, and you're going to lay out if there is compensation, how that's going to work. You're going to put in provisions as to what the carrier is obligated to do from a medical behavioral standpoint during the course of the pregnancy. And it'll get down to such mundane details as she can't be around litter boxes. It's going to regulate how much, you know, when or if she can have sex with her partner or her husband, that she's got to stay, she can't fly at certain stages of the pregnancy, just sorts of things that she would have been contractually obligated to not do in order to protect the pregnancy. There will be provisions in there about selective reductions, how many embryos are going to be transferred, how many children will she be expected to carry to term, what will be the basis for her to back out of the contract or for the intended parents to back out of the contract, what's going to happen in the event of death of either the intended parents or the carrier or the carrier spouse. There will often be obligations to do estate planning as part of the whole process. You need to have, both sides need to have wills in place. There will be the, and like I say, the compensation is a big part of these contracts. Is she going to be paid a fee for pain and suffering? How are the medical expenses going to be paid? Maternity clothing. If the carrier goes on bed rest, is there going to be compensation? Medical insurance. Is medical insurance going to cover this? If it's not, who's going to pay for it? How is it going to be paid? There will be provisions of money being put in an escrow account, how that's going to be managed and how the money gets distributed out. There will be life insurance provisions. Oftentimes the carrier wants to have a life insurance policy. That will be provided for. How is it? Who's going to pay for it? Who are the beneficiaries going to be? So basically anything like that we could imagine. As you can imagine, as this area of law has evolved, these contracts have gotten longer and longer. It's not unusual to have a 25 to 30-page contract now that addresses every possible contingency. So they're long and involved contracts.
Thank you. Do you address the issue of if there's a dispute sometime during the pregnancy between the surrogate and the intended parents, do you determine who's going to pay the legal fees if that's needed at
yes,
that point?
That's a common provision, too. There will often be a jurisdiction and venue provision that says if there are disputes on this contract and it must be litigated, what venue will it occur in? Will it be in the state of Minnesota? Will it be in the state of Arizona if one of the parties lives outstate? It will also have provisions that are kind of damages provisions that say if somebody is found to be in breach of the contract, they will pay the attorney's fees of the other side, kind of standard contract language in that regard. I'm putting in my contracts, and I'm seeing it more and more often, alternative dispute resolution provisions so that if there are any disputes, the parties are mandated to go to mediation to work it out. I have seen binding arbitration clauses. I'm not a fan of binding arbitration necessarily, but that's becoming more and more common in these contracts. One other thing I should mention, Representative Scott, that's in these contracts is there's also provisions that talk about how you're going to get the parentage established. That will often be laid out. Some of these cases, depending on how they're put together, you need to do an adoption in order to secure the legal parentage. It will require the carrier and her husband, if she has one, to work to comply with all the requirements for the adoption. You may need a termination of parental rights proceeding to secure the legal parentage. And all of that gets spelled out in these contracts so everybody knows, you know, what they're required to do from start to finish.
And so do you think that if we come up with some law and some regulation that addresses much of this, do you think that that's going to what am I trying to say? So if we have regulation, do you expect us to address all these concerns, or do you expect the contracts to still have to be somewhat individualized?
Well, I do know from the state, because there are a handful of states that have comprehensive legislation, similar to what we've got with the adoption practice. And from talking to colleagues in these various academies that I belong to, they have found them to be helpful. Because I think it's helpful to always have sort of an affirmative statement of the law as to what are the basic requirements and who can do these processes. I know the statutes that I'm familiar with lay out who they apply to, you know, whether they're married couples or not, or, you know, and so there's some real prescriptive provisions. But I do think that will help. And especially in this time when you can't force everybody to have attorneys, I think having a clear legislative sort of a recipe for how you go about doing this will certainly help the bench when they're looking at having to deal with unrepresented parties and, you know, what are the requirements in terms of getting this done. So I think it's good all around to help the practice, and I think you'll have less problems if there's an affirmative statement of the law.
And Madam Chair, one of the things that we heard testimony from, or actually it was written testimony in our last meeting, was from a physician who had been the physician over several surrogate women, and he noted that they wouldn't take his medical advice. And so even if you put down to the T that if the doctor says you're going to have bed rest, if you have to have, you know, if they clear down to how much sleep you're going to get, what your diet is, kind of micromanaging, if there's a quote-unquote breach, so how do you... I don't know how it's enforceable. I don't know how it's enforceable to make someone have bed rest, for instance.
Well, that's always one of the challenges in any kind of a legal proceeding. I mean, all of our laws, if somebody's not going to follow the law, they're not going to follow the law. And in the criminal area, we have consequences. You're going to go to jail. Here, the best that you can do is presumably, especially if it's compensated surrogacy, the consequence to the carrier for not doing that is she may not get all the financial support that was provided for in the contract. That's really the only remedy that you have over her to get her to comply with the contract. And, you know, it's the best that's out there in terms of, you know, trying to bring some sort of regulation to the process. But it's not perfect by any means, but it's the best that's available.
I'd like to ask a question.
Madam Chair?
Senator Benson, sorry.
No, thank you. I've been listening, and I haven't heard anybody ask about postpartum, and so perhaps our attorney can help us understand, what if the mother has a stroke during delivery or has nerve damage, you know, has a natural childbirth or has to have a cesarean section and has protracted complications? Are there short-term disability insurance in place? Are there ongoing medical supports in place for the mother who delivers the child? And what about if the child's born with complications? Who bears the responsibility for protecting that child? What if there's some concern that the mother might have been involved? If the mother says, no, I want a natural delivery, and the doctor recommends a cesarean section, and she having been experienced in pregnancy, decides that she doesn't want a cesarean section and something happens to that child. We haven't sort of talked about, everybody talks about the tears and the, you know, baby being born and going away and all of that. What if it's not perfect?
That's good questions. And there's about three of them there, and I'll try to hit them in some kind of logical order. First, in terms of postpartum concerns for the carrier or the surrogate, most of these contracts, and if I'm representing them, I would insist on having it in the contract, that there would be a provision for some period of time after the delivery of the child that carrier is provided with insurance coverage and therapy, payment for therapy. The common thing is I see 6 to 8 to 12 weeks post-pregnancy where she would continue to be able to have those kinds of services provided for and paid by the intended parents. And then oftentimes there will be insurance coverage available that will cover those sorts of things as well. And so typically that's a common part of the whole payment package that you put into this contract, is to make sure that there's coverage for that. any sort of complications related to the pregnancy would also be covered either by insurance or payment by the intended parents. In fact, common provision is if she loses her reproductive organs as a result of this, there's a payment typically provided, a liquidated damages clause, basically, so she would get X thousands of dollars to compensate for that. So we try to build in any of the sort of the unexpected tragedies that can come about on this and make sure that the carrier is made whole as a result of that. The situation with the child born of this process that may have extraordinary needs, I hope, and I do this when I'm counseling my intended parent clients, as I say, you know, this is no different than you having your own biological child. You take the child as it's born. Your child is born Down syndrome. With Down syndrome, that's your responsibility. You engage a carrier to carry a child, and that child is born with those conditions, and there wasn't a provision that talked about a selective reduction. You are responsible for that, no matter what condition the child is in. And quite frankly, that's one of the concerns why I think some of the county child protection units are watching over these cases and looking at this area, is because they're concerned, is this going to generate all sorts of children that are going to be rejected that then the state has to step in and care for? And I can tell you from my practice, I have not seen that. I know there are a few isolated situations where the courts have stepped in and said, no, you signed a contract, intended parent, you're going to be bound by this. This is your, you may decide you're not going to parent this child, but if this child goes into foster care or needs to be placed out, you're going to be financially responsible. So that's one of the benefits of having the contracts involved, is that it can go both ways. I mean, it can be enforceable contract against intended parents who may be having second thoughts, as well as the carrier. So I think it's these contracts, again, are broadly encompassing, and there's a lot of parties that are involved and a lot of interests, and the contracts have to be carefully drafted to address all of these issues.
My final question to you is, who's standing up for the rights of the child? Where do their rights come in?
Well, ideally, the last bastion would be the court, because ultimately the court has to approve these proceedings and has to sign off on whatever parentage process is being looked at. And so in that sense, the court would be the ultimate protector of the children's interests in these things. It's not unlike an adoption. Again, if I go back to my adoption analogy, in most adoptions outside of the state ward child protection adoptions, there is no guardian ad litem involved. The adoption code is premised on the idea that adoptive parents want this child more than anything in the world. The birth mother is making a carefully thought out decision to give up that child. And the idea is that these sets of parents coming together to create this new legal relationship are going to be looking out for the best interests of the child. Our family law in this country is premised on the idea that parents protect their children. We don't have guardians ad litem in every divorce case, for example. But you could have a guardian ad litem appointed in these cases that become litigated. If there's an issue with, say, a child that, you know, is got disabilities, the court would be able to appoint a guardian ad litem to advocate for that child. So I think the process is, there are several places where the children's interests come into play, but again, you have to analogize the situation to adoption and to other family law matters, and how do we protect children's interests in those cases? And I think the same sorts of considerations would apply here as well.
So we have a law in Minnesota that says you can, if you do not want to have your baby, you can put it into a, give it to a hospital or something like that, and no one is responsible.
Correct.
Now, that could happen. In this case, and the question I had was, what if the parents, you know, it takes a whole year, change their mind after a year. They're divorced. Now they don't like each other. They're you know, whatever. They're not going to be partners. And then the surrogate mother could say she doesn't want the baby. That isn't what I planned for at all. So then you could take it to a hospital.
Right. You're talking about the Good Samaritan law, that where you can drop off to. Yes. I think Senator Johnson, I think what we have to rely on is all of the processes and procedures that are out there already to deal with situations of children who are abused, neglected, abandoned in whatever circumstance. And, you know, that kind of thing, we can't prevent that from happening. I mean, no contract, no court order is going to prevent an intended parent from giving up their child a year after they get the child. No contract or court order is going to prevent a surrogate from saying, I'm going to keep this child, or I don't want to do this anymore. We just have to rely on the processes that are out there for children that end up in the system one way or another. and count on the various mechanisms in place to hold those parents accountable, whether it's through some sort of criminal prosecution, financial sanction, or some kind of a specific performance. But I think a lot of those processes are already out there, and we just have to recognize this process for what it is. It's another way to create a legally recognized parent-child relationship, similar to adoption, third-party custody, all these other processes that we have when people are building families through non-traditional means.
My concern, members, is that, you know, if the two parties agree that nobody wants the baby, then it's going to go to the state.
It very well could end up there.
And that's, really not very fair for a child.
No.
But, again, something that we are taking into our brains and coming up with whatever we need.
Madam Chair, just to comment to what you just said,
yes.
Though, it does seem to me that there is huge financial incentive for intended parents to keep their child because it is their egg and sperm, and they've paid a lot of money to the fertility clinic, to the agency, to the lawyers, to the, you know, we're talking about thousands of dollars, which is typically what people pay during the adoption process as well. So I think there's a huge financial motivation for them that, you know, I spent a lot of money because I really want this child to keep the child.
Well, and that sort of represents, Senator Pappas, that goes to this whole question of exploitation of carriers. I don't know if I said this or not, but this is not a scientific study, but I can tell you the majority of the carriers that we have worked with in our cases over the years have been school teachers and nurses. I don't know why that is, but I have not had intended parents who are going out to look for disadvantaged carriers, people with mental health issues, chemical. I mean, they want somebody who is very solid, and they're willing to pay the money to do it. And as you said, the financial incentive is there in a positive sense, in that way, is that they want a good outcome. And to the extent they've got control over putting this process together, they're going to try to put the best pieces together to get the best outcome. And I think if all the professionals are doing their jobs and following their ethical codes of professional responsibility, the outcome can be good, and that's what the track record has been so far.
Thank you very much. It's been a very good testimony that you provided to us. We have Andrea and Samantha. Maybe if you can come up together. If we can make it very brief, we have. So if you're telling us something that we haven't heard before.
Okay. My name is Andrea Hendrickson, and I am supporting about 57 individual gestational carriers that have been throughout the state of Minnesota. And I am bringing to the table that I did a lot of my research via social media. Through my research, I was able to find online groups to help me with my process of finding which agencies to work with and those that I should avoid, because there are those that you should avoid. There are different laws in different states as far as when intended parents come to me and say, do you think you could carry for me? And I would say, yes, I could. However, there are different laws in every state that help us, and I feel that in the state of Minnesota, if we could get this to be more, sorry, I'm completely losing my track of mind here, if we could get this into law of how we handle the contract and the surrogacy stipulations, as you see on the back of this is what we follow, even as a surrogate who has done one agency surrogacy and then have done three independent surrogacies. I still followed. I still saw a mental health professional. My husband saw a mental health professional. We had attorneys, one for myself and one for the family that I was caring for. We had to have permission from the reproductive endocrinologist. I had to have permission from my obstetrics doctor to say, yes, this person is still able to carry. I believe that she is a good candidate to carry for this family. And then you have the agency reviews too. So at any point we could, I know that she had pointed out that there was only 6% of surrogates who make it through agencies. And I feel that we're not being exploited to the point of we have the ability to do our own research. We have the ability to find resources, whether it be through a community of women who can help us see the light at the end of the tunnel, to go through all of the hardships that we go through in pregnancies with intended parents as well. We not only experience losses as gestational surrogates, we also see and are able to hand this crying, wiggly newborn to the arms of these parents who've wanted this baby, who've gone through this entire infertility and losing their own babies or not getting pregnant at all, and now they're finally at this end stage where they get to have this baby of their own. And it's just, it's a complete miracle. And to be able to give that to them and to be able to have the law kind of on everyone's side, and just to be able to have some conformity, if you will.
And that is what we are here for.
Yes.
We have Andrea.
I'm Samantha Levine.
Oh, Samantha.
I come to you as a traditional surrogate, so I am different from all of these other surrogates here, but at the same time, I'm the same as them. I came to I had a desire to help this family, and it started off as a gestational process. We went through the in vitro, the embryos, no, they didn't survive, and so at that point, the doctor told her that she could no longer proceed with this process, that her eggs were not viable. So we were at the point of termination of everything. And for me, it was something that I had to pray about a lot. And it came to me that I get rid of an egg every single month. And to me, it's just an egg. It's not a baby. It never will be, because that month it's just an egg. For me, it became possible to be her baby at that point. And so for me, it was, there should be no reason why I can't just donate my egg at the same time as carry her baby for her. I guess I'm open to any questions, because this is a different situation than a lot of the others, and I know you haven't heard from a traditional surrogate, so I open the table for you.
That is true. I don't think we've had anyone come before us as a surrogate, as a traditional surrogate, and so we appreciate it. Our time is very small, and we have Harold Cassidy, an attorney that is on the phone. Is that correct, Sally?
No, he's
here. Okay, from New Jersey. So just a moment, Mr. Cassidy, because Senator Pappas has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question for Ms. Levine. So have you done both? Have you been a gestational carrier and you did this traditional, or did you just
not
do the one?
I have just been the traditional so far.
So could you just share with us, and you have children of your own.
I do. I have four children, and I'm currently pregnant with my fifth.
And could you just share with us, please, did you have any different emotional feelings after the birth of the baby that you were giving to the intended parents as opposed to your own children, just your own state of mind?
It was completely different. My husband and I went into this thinking that I don't want to hold the baby. I don't want any of, I want there to be no emotional connection, and I wanted a month's worth of time to actually not even touch, hold any of that. And for me, that was just to, keep myself safe, which ended up not affecting me at all. I held the baby the next day, because to me, this was a beautiful baby that was theirs. I had no emotional connection, as I did with my own children. I was so excited for them and watching them hold this child that it was amazing. She got to help be down there, deliver the baby. That was her baby she got to bring into this world. She couldn't be me and carry it, which was extremely hard for me, as she couldn't feel the kicks. We ended up having sleepovers just so she could lay next to my belly and feel the baby as much as possible. It's so much of a gift that I can't even imagine feeling any different than excitement at that point of delivery for her. That it was absolutely beautiful. I'm so proud that I'm emotionally strong, and we went through a lot. When I started off as a gestational carrier, we went through the psychological testing there. But when it changed over and we decided to move towards traditional, our attorneys would not continue with us until we went through more psychological testing and evaluations. And it was very extensive, but I was so willing to do anything to help them that that was fine with me. I was more than happy to go through any extra that that they would recommend for that, for a traditional surrogate.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you. Mr. Cassidy.
If I may, let me begin by thanking Madam Chairwoman, Chairwoman Johnson, Chairwoman Scott, and members of the committee to invite me here to share with you my experiences and what expertise I have in this area. So I think there is a fundamental question that has to be asked that seems to be skipped over here. I don't think the question is so much whether what regulation you should have as the fundamental question of whether surrogacy in any form should be legalized, whether the state, this state or any state, should actually enforce these contracts. And I think that there are some issues that have to be examined very carefully. So what I've given you are two things. One is a short bio. And there are three cases that I was involved in that are teaching cases that can illustrate a lot of the intrinsic problems that I think are absolutely incurable in surrogacy, and that there's no amount of regulation that can cure them. I also provide a little overview, and in the very beginning of the overview, I have a list of the things that I brought with me that I'm going to leave behind because I think they'll be helpful to the committee. Attached to the overview is a model surrogacy statute that prohibits the enforcement of a surrogacy contract and is also a list of facts of a case that's ongoing in California, in the California federal and state courts right now. The draft of the model bill mirrors recommendations that were made in my state. I'm from New Jersey. In my state, following the Baby M case, which we litigated, surrogacy was banned throughout Europe. It was criminalized. Still is. And most recently, on the list of things that I'm providing you is the statement of the European Parliament, which declared surrogacy as a grave civil rights violation, and their focus is on the women. And they find the European Parliament restated after 30 years that it's a human rights violation because it's intrinsically exploitative of women. Now, I know that we hear many stories about women who find acting as a surrogate, either where the mom is genetically related or where she's not genetically related, as satisfying. And all of these issues that we talk about, ironically, were actually addressed in the very first case, in the Baby M case. And the Supreme Court of New Jersey, in a unanimous decision, put it this way. They said, beyond that, it's a potential degradation of some women that may result from this arrangement. The fact, however, that many women may not perceive surrogacy negatively, but rather see it as an opportunity, does not diminish its potential for devastation for other women. Now, I see the dark side and the ugly side of surrogacy. I take calls from all around the country from women who, without question, are exploited. So when we look at the question of surrogacy, if you look at the overview, we can't ignore the child. And I will tell you, among the things that I am going to leave behind are detailed declarations from Dr. Alma Golden and Dr. Miriam Grossman, who explain something that was first taught to us, if I can use those terms, by the New Jersey Bioethics Commission when it issued its 178-page report following Baby Act. And that commission said the evils or harms associated with surrogacy arrangements where the mom who gives birth is genetically related or all present where the mom is not genetically related. So when that was issued, one of the points they made was that pregnancy plays an extremely important role in the building the basis for a lifelong loving relationship between a mother and a child. For us to dismiss it as having value is a grave mistake. And so I'm going to urge that the question you look at is, should we allow this in the first place? Now, our Bioethics Commission said no. The European Parliament says no, it should be criminalized. And when we say criminalized, they're talking about criminalizing the commercial components of the arrangement. So Dr. Golden and Dr. Grossman go through the explanation of what happens during the pregnancy, you know, the rising oxytocin levels that we're all aware of, and the physiological bonding. There isn't just a psychological component to this. It's a physiological bonding. And this existing relationship between the mother and child. They go through that explanation. They talk about the benefits to the child and also the role that a mother plays. Now, I also have Dr. Caruso's declaration. He was a reproductive endocrinologist who used to do these arrangements, and he explains all of the physical risks to the child and to the mother. And I will tell you that in the case of Melissa Cook, she was on a drug regimen that lasted 75 days, and when they were done, there are significant risks. He explains them all. There are higher risks for the child to have genetic anomalies, and there's higher risks for the mother who carries the child in a surrogacy than normal situations. So here are some of the issues that I think are very important to be looked at. So first of all, let me tell you this. I don't doubt for a minute that a surrogacy statute, an enabling statute that enforces these contracts, is unconstitutional. I'll be happy to litigate it. I'm litigating one now. No court has ever addressed the issue. It violates the constitutional rights of the mother, and it violates the constitutional rights of the children. So throughout our history, the central focus of all child rearing is what's in the best interest of the child. I don't think that I overstate it to say that if surrogacy were widespread, absolutely widespread, it has the potential to irrevocably alter human civilization. Before we go down that path any further, there are many issues that must be looked at. So here, for the first time, we're talking about writing laws that are not going to have its central purpose the protection or the best interest of the children. It's going to be the desires of the adults. And we are fundamentally shifting the focus of child rearing from one thing to another. I'm going to suggest, before we do that any further, that these issues have to be looked at carefully. Surrogacy is a plan, before the child is even conceived, to what? Separate a baby from the mother who carried the child. We've never done that before. Our policy in this country has always been that to the fullest extent possible, every child has the right and opportunity to get to know, love, and build a relationship with both natural parents. And so what are we doing here? We're deliberately making that impossible. And I'm going to talk a little bit about California, because California has been dealing with this for 20, 25 years, and it is a model of where this leads. No one in California has to be related to the child to be a so-called intended parent. No one in California has to be married to be a so-called intended parent. So what you have in the Cook case is a 50-year-old man in Georgia, where it's not legal, going to a surrogacy broker in California, driven by nothing other than profit in this instance, who does not do a home visit, does not have any idea whether this man, who's 50 years old, single, living in the basement of his parents' home, who's deaf, doesn't speak, whether he's capable of raising these children. And some doctor in Southern California, in exchange for money, without knowing who's going to raise the child, there's a triple embryo transfer in a woman who would be 48 years old on the date of the birth. But before I go back into that, so there are things that are incurable. If you go down this path, this child will not ever get to know and build a loving relationship with the mother who carried her. So the child has a fundamental constitutional right to maintain a relationship with the mother who carried her. Surrogacy violates that right and violates that whole process. There is no question, no matter what the language is that's chosen, there's no question that surrogacy involves the sale of a child. What the intended parent is bargaining for is not a service to carry a child, but what they're bargaining for is exclusive custody and control over the child. In California, when this man indicated that he could not take care of the children, that he wasn't capable of raising three children, and the mother who carried the child said, "I'll take care of one or more," the court said on the record, what happens to these children is no business of the court. It's not my job. And she was construing the statute. Every enabling statute in this country, there are about 24 states that will enforce these contracts either by statute or by case law. In every instance of the statutory instance, the best interest of the child is not considered. So when this man says, "I can't take care of these children," and the mom who's pregnant with the children says, "I will," then the court says, "I don't have any power to determine what's in children's best interest." There's no question that to award parentage based upon a promise made before the children even existed is a violation of the equal protection rights of the children. There's no question about it. So let's really look at what we're talking about. We're talking about using a document that is signed before the children exist, before the mom even has the relationship with the child, before we even know if the children will ever come into existence. And we're going to use that document as a waiver of future rights of the children, a waiver of future rights of the mother, without any regard for whether it's a good idea, whether the mother really understands what she's getting into and what she's not getting into. Now, I was here earlier today, and I was listening to some of the testimony, and Dr. Simmons had said that the inference in what she said was that if you are opposed to surrogacy, you are assuming that the mother is ignorant and disadvantaged, and you come out with one conclusion. But if you assume that she's capable of making intelligent decision, then you come out to a different one. Well, what happens with the Mary Beth Whiteheads, the Elizabeth Canes, the AGRs, the Melissa Cooks, and the list go on and on and on, when they say, wait a minute, I now understand this is not in the best interest of the children. This is not in my best interest. Why don't we respect that intelligent decision? We do it in adoption. So we are proposing to completely change all the protections. Now, I don't appreciate the analogy to adoption that we heard earlier, and I'll explain to you why. So in adoption, as adoption law developed, and there were situations where a mother could not raise a child, which happened. The culture had to come to the rescue of those children and provide them with a home. And as they started doing that, it became clear that women were being exploited, that women were being pressured or forced into having abortions they really didn't want to have. I mean, giving up a child they didn't want to give up. That's how I first got into this. Back in 1981, when women came to me who were being pressured into having assigning consents and surrendering children to adoption. They came to me, and we were able to get the babies back at times. I'll tell you, in that process, in the early 80s, when I sat in on their counseling sessions, I will tell you that there is a very unique, special form of pain that's associated with the separation of a mother from a baby when she doesn't want to be separated. And I heard women's counseling sessions and group sessions 10, 15, 20 years after the event. So what happened was we had to protect those women so they wouldn't be exploited. And so a woman who was in 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 8 months pregnancy, if she felt she couldn't raise the child, we would never, ever honor a written consent to surrender her rights before the baby was born. Why? Because she would never know fully the depth of her love and her bond with the child until she went through it. So the laws in every state would not enforce a consent prior to the birth of the child. Only after the child was born would they take a consent, and even then in most states the consent could be revoked. And even in that instance, a judge had to decide in a court of law that the consent was informed and voluntary. And in most states, if the record doesn't support it, the judgment could be vacated. So we had all these protections. We're throwing them all out with surrogacy. Every protection is thrown out. The mother has a fundamental right to a relationship with her child. Now, I don't like some of the terminology that is used in this debate. The mother who carries a child is the mother, whether she's genetically related or not. I know people use the term traditional, but there's nothing traditional about this. This is a radical break from the way that we saw the mother-child relationship as the center and core of all civilized society. So the mother has rights. The mother has rights.
Thank you, Mr.
Cassidy. Yes.
Representative Allen, did you want to ask a question?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You started out like you were arguing before the Supreme Court, and you probably wouldn't have gotten past the equal, when you started talking about equal protection and legal status of the mother, you probably wouldn't have had to listen to any of it because we would have been stuck on that part. So I understand you're making a legal argument, but you don't have any support for it. But and then you're going into sort of ethical, which is interesting, the ethical part. It is sort of interesting, but it's not really factual. And then as far as the you're advocating for the protection of the surrogate mother who does not have a legal parent-child relationship. And you're saying that there's no, relationship, then how under, so adoption was meant to create that legal, in some way that already exists, even without, under our current law, without a contract, that if the parents, they're the biological parents, and they can prove it through testing, then they should, that legal relationship exists and should be protected.
Okay.
So how are we going to create?
Okay. So first of all, I am going to leave behind a brief for you, which addresses the constitutional issues. I will leave behind for you a brief that addresses the constitutional issues, and there's no doubt in my mind that it's unconstitutional. So. But what you're talking, so what? One of the points that's being made here is that in an adoption, the legal status, where there are two different things here. One is the factual biological relationship. As a matter of fact, the mother who carries the child, who bonds, and the only person that the baby knows is the mother who carries the child. The child bonds with that mother. Okay, that factual relationship is one thing. Legally, the law in an adoption terminates the legal status of the mom who gives birth, and it confers legal status through a court proceeding on someone who is not the biological mother. The same thing happens here in this sense. The mother who carries the child is, in fact, the mother and, in fact, has legal status. So in a statute, an enabling statute like in California, it requires a court order to terminate her rights. Now, the fact that they're doing it pre-birth does not in any way obscure the fact that they are terminating her rights. She has constitutional rights, and she has rights under state law. The contract to terminate any woman's rights, there has to be a legal basis. It can be what we call voluntary, involuntary, as you know. Involuntary, the state may come in because the child's being abused and terminate the rights of a parent against the parent's will. In involuntary termination, there has to be a document that forms the basis to terminate the rights. In an adoption, it's a surrender document. You know, it could be a private adoption, it could be an agency adoption. In surrogacy, it's the contract. They're pointing to the contract, and they're saying this contract was properly entered into, and that's the basis to terminate rights. They still have to terminate the mother's rights. There is no other mother. There are two fundamental assumptions you have to assume and accept and embrace to have a surrogacy enabling statute. And this was in the AGR case, which was the first what we call so-called gestational surrogacy contested cases in New Jersey where I litigated, and the mom who carried the child, who was not genetically related, was found to be the legal mother, contract was deemed unenforceable, the consent was deemed void, the consent for an adoption was deemed void in that instance, okay? They brought in two experts. One expert flew from California to tell us about the history of how women in this country at one point in the 19th century were reduced to having the role of bearing children for men, and how women fought for their rights. And she goes through this analysis, and she goes at the end of the process, she then says, we should create, in effect, a class of women to carry children for men. You have to accept the idea that we should do that. The second thing, the second assumption was that mothers provide no particular benefit to children. So, we have So we have those two expert reports here that I'm leaving behind that explain how uniquely mothers who carry children provide benefit to mothers provide the benefit to the children. You have to embrace and accept that we can have a single man in Georgia raise a child and the mother provides no benefit to that child to embrace this concept. I'll add another thing. Well, it goes to the point.
Before we move on to that, Madam Chair, could I ask
Representative Allen?
So what exactly is it that is being terminated? So the contract, it's trying to transfer custody of the child once the surrogate mother delivers the child. So, and it is. I agree with you that the woman's body or that's controversial. So that if you bed rest, abortion, all those issues become really complex. But when you're talking about the child, once the child is born, the termination of legal rights. What is it that is being terminated?
The surrogate mother.
Oh. No, not the child. How I view it is that the woman that gave birth has custody of the child, has possession of the child, but she doesn't have. She's not the biological mother. So at that point, it's sort of undetermined that the contract sort of determines the legal rights of the parties. But under the law, I mean, that if there was a dispute, as said, the mother's going to lose because she's not doesn't have any standing.
Okay, so I've litigated all these questions.
We need to let him finish with his testimony.
Yeah.
Okay. And the mother who carries the child is the biological mother. She may not be the genetic mother, but she is the biological mother, and she is the only person, actually, at that point on the day of birth, who has any constitutional rights. Okay? A man who donates sperm does not have constitutional rights. They are given an opportunity under state law to establish a relationship that could take on constitutional dimension. And I don't need to go through layer in all of those cases.
Continue with one more question and then finish your testimony.
Sure.
Mr. Cassidy,
yes.
Aren't you? I mean, I understand your ethical beliefs relative to the concept of surrogacy itself, and your beliefs are what they are. But aren't you confusing the legal concepts here? Biology, as determined by genetic testing, to form parentage and paternity through the courts of just about every state under the Uniform Parentage Acts, has to do with genetic connections and has nothing to do with a woman's status as a carrier or someone delivering a child. The same thing is true with a man donating sperm or a biological father of a child. It's determined through genetic testing. That's where the biological aspect of it comes through. Nothing non-genetic is conferred on a parent by being a carrier. Isn't it? And the second concept I have is you said before this becomes widespread, and I think that's a blatant mischaracterization because, as you stated, 24 states by statute or case law allow for the enactment of gestational or surrogacy contracts and will actually weigh in on and enforce them. And in the other states that don't have them, such as Minnesota, and that's why we're here, hundreds and hundreds of surrogacy cases come before the courts all the time.
May I address what you said one point at a time?
Please.
Number one, every state in the union, Madam Chairwoman, every state in the union confers legal status on a woman who gives birth. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I'm going to suggest as a constitutional lawyer that woman, whether the state conferred that relationship legally or not, which they do, that was the Uniform Parentage Act, the language is in every state's statute, whether they did or not, constitutionally, the relationship that a mother has during pregnancy is constitutionally protected. Okay. As to widespread, when Gail Robinson gave birth to twins in the year 2006, SART reported that those two babies were two of only 256 children born to so-called gestational surrogates. This is not widespread within my definition. It can be contained. I think it needs to be studied. If you want to talk about, let me tell you one little. In the case of Cook, okay, what happened there is there was a triple embryo transfer. When the man found out that there were three children, he demanded, first he talked about aborting all of them, then he demanded having an abortion of one of them, and then ultimately they referred to the so-called selective reduction provisions of the contract. And their insistence, his insistence and his lawyer's insistence that she abort one or more of the children was based upon their fear that there would be a risk to all of the children, the health to all of the children. Dr. Caruso addresses in one of my things I'm going to leave behind, the risks of the selective reduction. There are tremendous risks to the selective reduction. She refused. And in response to her refusal, there was a campaign driven against her. And if this is the last point that I get to make today, please let me make it. And the lawyer for the so-called intended parent threatened her with a massive lawsuit. She contacted the lawyer who had been given to her as the lawyer during the contract phase. Under the terms of the arrangement, the intended parent had to pay for the lawyer. And that's always the case. That lawyer who represented her represents intended parents in other instances. That lawyer was not free, and that lawyer was conflicted and could not argue for taking out the selective reduction provisions of that contract, and didn't. Then when a dispute arose, she tried to consult with the lawyer who had represented her in a contract phase, and that lawyer said, I can't because the intended parent didn't pay me for this. That lawyer nonetheless communicated with the lawyer for the intended parent about the selective reduction. 3 weeks later, she writes to my client, Melissa, that she can represent her now because the intended parent is paying her to consult with her on the selective reduction. And then she went about the business of telling her why she had to have the selective reduction and why she was going to be liable for money damages if she didn't. That is incorrect advice. She could never be sued for exercising her constitutional right to carry the child. So your challenge is if Minnesota decides that they want to allow this and enforce it, the challenges for trying to regulate this are going to be overwhelming. And I don't think you can do it. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks
very much. Thank you for
your hearing me.
Representative,
I'm sorry,
Scott.
Yes.
So my question, I guess, one of them would be, do you think that these contracts that are written up can be balanced for the interests of both of the parties? Or I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I think I've made it clear that I think that there are intrinsic harms that can't be overcome. Okay? So, but if a state were to attempt, because for some reason they want to enforce these contracts and make a woman give up the child, even if she thinks it's not in the child's best interest or in her own, then there are certainly some things that you have to consider. Okay? So I don't think it can be done. I don't think you can. The child is without a mother. We have made it so that we're separating a mother and a child, guaranteeing it before the child's even born. That's the plan. Okay, so I don't think you can, but.
Could you speak a little bit to, you referred to the constitutional rights of a mother to a child and the child to a mother. And do you have something here that cites some like case law or something? Because I know, you know, I've worked some on family law, and I've heard that.
I will leave behind a memorandum of law that we filed in the federal court in California in that particular motion before the court, it was a jurisdictional issue, so it doesn't go into great depth on the constitutional issues, but it does identify them, and it does provide support for it, because the federal constitutional issue was necessary to discuss, to talk about the jurisdictional issue. So I can leave that behind, and I will.
It is not in our packets today.
I have it with me. I'll leave them behind. And the, you know, Dr. Caruso's declaration I'll leave behind. He's the fellow who explains the risks to the mother and the child. That's extraordinary, different from regular pregnancy. I'm leaving behind a declaration from Dr. Kath Rothman, who is a well-known feminist psychologist who addresses the exploitation issue. And
Dr. Cassidy, do you have that online, or is that available?
I have it with me.
Paper,
Yeah, paper. I'm going to leave it behind. I don't have copies for everybody. If you want to make more copies, you can. I do have 3 copies of the Bioethics Commission report because it was so exhaustive. They spent 3 years on this. And they did look at the Johnson Calvert case.
Whatever you have, if you would give that to staff or
maybe it's not in here. It's not
here, so that we can.
Yeah, I shall. So one other last point, if you have the time. There's been some discussion about the siblings of the surrogate. When Baby M unraveled, it began because the 7-8-year-old daughter of the surrogate, one night when she was 7 months pregnant, was rubbing her abdomen and told her, "I really want to have a baby sister." And the adults retired that night and talked about how are we going to tell our daughter Tuesday that we gave up the baby in exchange for money so that she could go to college. That's what started the discussion. There's a man named Reuben Panner who wrote a book called The Adoption Triangle, and he was debating Bill Handel, one of the earliest surrogacy brokers in California, and they're on TV, and Bill Handel always brought happy surrogates, and there's no question that there are surrogates who, that there's an altruistic component to this. Every surrogate I ever represented told me that they did it for altruistic reasons publicly, and then privately they told me without the money I wouldn't have done it and couldn't have done it. So the money component is critical. But this surrogate brought a surrogate with her, and she was on TV, and she was talking about how rewarding it was for her to give the gift of life, with the term that she was using. At an intermission, at a commercial break, Dr. Panner turned to her and said, "How are the children doing?" And this particular woman said, she started to tell him how they were in therapy. She broke down and cried, and she couldn't continue, was taken away. Now, one of the doctors today was asked the question, "Is there any real studies on the impact on the other siblings?" The true answer is no, it's not really been studied. So one of the things that I say when this has to be studied more before we go forward any further, it's all of these issues. It's the impact on everybody all the way around. And I will tell you that there in California, I can't talk about Minnesota because we don't have it legalized in Minnesota. In California, you have an incestuous relationship like this. You have surrogacy brokers who will put together an agreement with a man in Georgia, with a woman who's going to be 48 when she gives birth, a doctor who does a triple embryo transfer not knowing who's going to raise the child, lawyers, and hospitals. Now, when those children were born, the Kaiser Hospital in Panorama City would not let this mother see the children. This mother who carried them, who worried about them, who literally saved their lives, they wouldn't tell her if they were alive, if they were well, what their weight was, and then posted 2 security guards on her floor to prevent her from seeing the children. They required anyone who went in to visit her. You want to talk about exploitation? To give identity. And they wouldn't let the visitors see the children. Why? Those children were in a hospital for 8 weeks, three children. And there is a study that shows that a hospital that takes care of triplets born to a surrogate makes literally, this will sound fantastic, but it's published, and I'm happy to send this study to you, 123 times more money than they will with a single birth with a married couple. And so you have this industry. Now, it wasn't like this 20 years ago in California. It started there, the way it's starting here in Minnesota. And it grew to this industry where it's all fueled by the money from intended parents, and everyone is going to do what is necessary to satisfy intended parents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we have talked with the other testifiers, and they said that they would be willing to come to our next meeting and be the first people who would testify. Scott run the meeting, and she says that's okay. So we will do that, and I thank you for being able to do that. Thank you. And with that, meeting adjourned. And any other questions or comments?